Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, is Massachusetts facing another evidence testing problem? A judge is questioning the accuracy of breathalyzer tests in some 20,000 drunk driving cases. We'll look at some of the implications. Also today, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Megan Marshall on the life of legendary poet Elizabeth Bishop and the importance of poetry today.
We may not write poetry, but we can try to write poetry. We may think we don't understand poetry, but give it a try and it can save your life.
Plus, we break down the history of controversial ads on the MBTA with our senior media analyst, John Carroll. And we know the lyrics of the Battle Hymn of the Republic, but what do we know about the woman who wrote them, Julia Ward Howe, and a look at her own personal and cultural battles? All that ahead on Radio Boston after this news.
Glory, glory, hallelujah.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The accuracy of thousands of breathalyzer tests in Massachusetts is now in question after a judge found that the state did not prove that it had a scientifically sound way to calibrate its breath tests. That could affect, by some estimates, 20,000 drunk driving cases. Joining us to talk about this is Nancy Gertner, a former federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's legal analyst. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
So what do you make of this ruling? We should say that these breath tests and what we're talking about here were used from 2012 to 2014.
Right. So, the court said that 2014 going forward, they met the scientific standards. But the court made findings which are really quite stunning, which is that sort of critical scientific information about the protocols for testing the machine, about what the standards were determined by word of mouth. And then there were meetings of the scientists who were talking about, how they were going to do things, how they were going to calibrate, how they're going to test. There were also in informal meetings without records. So that means that no one could supervise what was going on. And that actually relates to the Farrakh and Ducan scandals.
Okay, those are other drug evidence testing scandals.
Right.
Former chemist Danny Ducan and former chemist Sonia Farrakh. Yep.
Right, because they... The idea was not just occasionally, you could wind up with a tech that is doing something wrong. The issue is what are the circumstances under which it will be found out?
Mm-hmm.
And without written records, without written protocols, without written standards, then it is easier for someone to both make a mistake or go rogue, essentially, which is what happened in those cases.
Right. Now, these machines themselves were challenged, and the judge said, no, the machines are okay. It's the calibration of these machines, right? Is
right.
that what we're talking
right.
about?
So, the machine had to be set. There were standards for setting it. There were standards for measuring the particular sample against other samples. And you had to determine, those were judgments that essentially the calibrator had to make according to certain protocols. And if the person was doing this informally based on word of mouth, then you couldn't count on the protocols being followed. Mm. And it's like a black box, right? You can't have a machine that suddenly you put in information and it spits out something. You have to know that the way that they did it was consistent with scientific protocols.
Because we've had these other problems with testing, drug evidence testing that you mentioned with Annie Ducan and Sonia Farrakh, I'm wondering what you think this does for the public's confidence in testing. I mean, do you think it will result in more challenges to the reliability of tests?
I think it will. There's sort of a going forward and a looking back problem. Going forward, I think this will encourage stricter standards that the courts will apply. This decision was very carefully done. And the public can have confidence going forward. Looking back, we've had bumps in the road, more than bumps in the road. The Ducan and Farrakh standards are really fundamental challenges to the integrity of the process. This is more a question of carelessness than someone actually intentionally trying to upend the process.
Mm-hmm.
So going back, we have concerns, but looking forward, it should be better.
But the message of carelessness is a big one. I mean, mean, if in fact it was a word-of-mouth system that was supposed to determine the accuracy of machines and sentences for people who could go to prison, and it really affects their lives, I mean, what does that say? Does it say something about our criminal justice system?
It says something about our criminal justice system in the past. I mean, that's the question. The question is whether judges will be careful about any kind of testing going forward. And these kinds of decisions promote that. Now the system has to deal with what we've seen now in the drug testing area, which is the dislocation that comes from results which could not be trusted scientifically being admitted into evidence. But that's something the system's going to have to deal with.
I want to go to the Supreme Judicial Court, which was also involved in this drunk driving issue, breathalyzer test issue. The Supreme Court, State Supreme Judicial Court, has really had a ton of changes. Most recently, last week, Justice Margo Botsford retired. Where does that leave things?
Well, there will be her vacancy, and then Judge Jerry Hines will be retiring in the middle of the summer, I believe. There's a mandatory 70 retirement, and so that has accounted for four of the five vacancies that are on the Supreme Judicial Court. Three have already been filled. One vacancy was someone who retired earlier, who resigned earlier. But no, it gives Governor Baker the ability to put five people on a seven-person court, which is extraordinary. Mm.
And what do you think so far of the folks that he's chosen?
These have been fine candidates, but this court has been a distinguished court way beyond any in the country. Three of its members went on to the U.S. Supreme Court. Oliver Wendell Holmes was on the court. There have been giants on this court, sort of befitting a court that has really dealt with major state constitutional issues, the death penalty, abortion, criminal justice issues, and been more protective of rights than has the U.S. Supreme Court. So I would want to be careful. I would want to make sure that the next two appointments are filled with people of the caliber of Margo Botsford.
Mm. And tell us a little bit about her. Not many folks, I think, know about the inner workings of the state Supreme Judicial
right.
Court. So what does her retirement mean? And what did she do? What do you think her legacy is?
Well, the best way to describe it is what Justice Gant said, which is as fine a writer and thinker as has ever served the court. Now, that is an amazing statement. And what was significant about her was not only the work that she did and the clarity of it and the extent to which she created consensus. That's terribly important. That's the difference between our Supreme Judicial Court and the U.S. Supreme Court. These have been consensus decisions, the ones that I've described. But also he described her as a mentor to all the other judges. These will be very big shoes to fill.
Mm. And one of the cases now before the SJC, and this was argued last week, involves drug users' access to clean needles, specifically a needle exchange program in Hyannis. The town says it's illegal for a private group to distribute needles and that only pharmacies or the State Department of Public Health can do that. So what is the big issue here that you think the SJC needs to determine, and what are your thoughts about that?
Well, on the one hand, when needle exchanges were decriminalized, it had been criminal to distribute needles in the past. When that was decriminalized, an AIDS group and other groups said that means that we can distribute, we can give out needles for free. The statute said that the pharmacies are the only ones that can sell, but they say the AIDS group said that we're not selling, we're distributing. And then other regulations suggest how the public health department might distribute needles. So the question really is whether there was a gap in the law that allowed private groups like the AIDS Action Group to distribute needles for free, or whether essentially the government and local authorities have to be the gatekeeper. The interpretation that they want to give suggests that they have to be the gatekeeper and not the AIDS Action Group.
Hmm. Well, I'm wondering, do you think that this could result in some restrictions? You know, there are lots of needles being handed out now. Things have changed dramatically in the 11 years since this 2006 state law was passed, allowing pharmacies and state-run programs to distribute needles. But, you know, now we've got an opioid epidemic
right,
on our hands.
Right.
And a lot of people don't want to be next to a needle exchange program. So could there be pressure here, do you think? Could this get sent back to the legislature? I mean, I'm just wondering.
if they determine that there's a gap in the statute that enables other entities like an AIDS action group to distribute needles for free, if they determine there's a gap, yes, the legislature can step in. I mean, there's an opioid crisis, but there is also a crisis with dirty needles. Mm-hmm. And so the question is how to deal with that. And on the one hand, going through local authorities, you run into the, not in my backyard problem. On the other hand, you want to regulate this to some degree. So I think that it's a real dilemma. And the court is dealing with a very narrow statutory issue. If there's a gap, then maybe the legislature can come back. If it's already covered by the existing legislation, then the gatekeeper would be the public health department.
And I just want to ask you in the last 2 minutes that we have here, your take on another legal story, and that involves State Attorney General Maura Healey. Last week she said she's not going to comply with a congressional subpoena from a House committee for documents relating to her investigation into ExxonMobil. What do you think of that? You're smiling.
Well, there's an incredible irony here, which is that the Republicans during the previous administrations have raised the importance, and not unreasonably, of federalism. That is to say, states regulating within their borders. Attorney General Healey has done that. The investigation of ExxonMobil is about ExxonMobil's misrepresentations, she claims, to Massachusetts residents about climate change. If the Republicans are true to their view of the structure of this country, then the Attorney General should be allowed, has a constitutional right, actually, and the constitutional authority to investigate consumer issues within the four corners of the Commonwealth.
Hmm. So I think we'll hear a lot more about this fight. Yeah, this is not even close to over.
Right.
Okay, Nancy Gertner, former federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's legal analyst. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You probably know these television commercials.
At Bernie and Phil's, our family has something for everyone in your family.
Bernie and Phil, quality, comfort, and price. That's nice.
It might be hard to forget that jingle, coined for Bernie and Phil's furniture. Their most recent ad campaign for the MBTA, though, takes a different approach. The company's latest MBTA billboards resemble personal ads, such as touting sectional sofas that are, quote, really into the group thing, end quote. The ads are getting some attention on social media, and they've caught the eye of BU professor and WBUR senior media analyst John Carroll. Thanks for coming into our studio.
Nice to be here.
So describe some of these Bernie and Phil's furniture ads on the tee.
Sure. First, let me give a tip of the hat to Greg Ryan over at the Boston Business Journal, who was actually the first one to write about this. Mm-hmm. These, as you say, they're formulated like personal ads. So one has in all caps the headline, "Having problems with your wife?" And then underneath it says, "Then sleep with me and get the best night's sleep of your life right after your body cuddles up on top of me. Sofas now in stock and ready for delivery." So there's I can read more if you want.
No. But I'm just wondering, so they're risque.
They're risque. Some would say they're suggestive. They're certainly edgy. Mm-hmm. And that's what they want. That's what Bernie and Phil's want. It's a quantum leap from where they were before.
Right. Very different from sort
kind of
whiplash-y. Family jingle, old-fashioned jingle. So what's the strategy here, do you think?
The strategy is to try to attract younger shoppers. So they have a series of TV spots out that are pretty clever. They take old black and white footage from movies and redub the voiceover to reflect a furniture sell, basically to direct people to Bernie and Phil's.
I actually think we have a clip of that. Let's listen.
Why should I go to Bernie and Phil's, you ugly mug?
Because you're going to need new furniture.
Ah!
Look at that flowered chair. It's hideous.
It's not that bad.
And now you're going to need a new lamp. And that chair is terrible, too. Get up!
It doesn't sound too over the top.
No, those are different. They're just spoofs, and they're pretty funny. They're pretty clever.
Mm-hmm. So let's just talk about who created these new ads, so we can tell folks this is a New York based firm, right? DeVito Verde, which does have a bit of a history with controversial ads. Last summer, the firm produced a series of parody political campaign ads, the Hillary Clinton cold fish ad,
right,
that got a lot of attention. And we spoke when that ad came out. We on Radio Boston spoke with Ellis Verde, president of of the firm about that. Let's listen.
I've had a very good experience with her. I don't think there's any political bent or any kind of personal front here. It's really just advertising and commercial use.
And then, John, we contacted Verdi again today about this Bernie and Phil's campaign ad, and Verdi says this is a cost-effective way for Bernie and Phil's to increase business and brand awareness and to get attention from a younger audience. Let's listen.
It could be a little boring hanging out on the tee sometimes, and this is a in some way, shape, or form, some form of entertainment. But it's not, and like entertainment, it's not for everybody. But at the same time, it's good to talk about it, air it out, and have a discussion.
So, John Carroll, entertainment.
Well, before you can see these ads, the trolley actually has to show up. So, so that's something a little bit different. But I think they stand out. There are some clever ads on the T. The T has tried to increase its transit ad revenue as much as possible. There are some clever ones, and there are some really boring ones. So these are there basically to get attention. Mm-hmm. There's so much clutter out there at this point that the Big Bang Theory is something that people use all the time, which is, you know, just get on people's radar screen, and and that's three-quarters of the battle at this point.
Do we know if these ads would get the same kind of attention in another city? Are we stuffy? That's essentially what I'm trying to say here. You know, in New York, if these ads ran, would anyone, you know, bat an eye, or is this, do you think this is unique to Boston?
Be a big yawn in New York. Mm-hmm. You should see some of the ads on the subway. They're way beyond this. This is really subtle compared to what you see down in New York. I think, you know, Boston has a reputation as being a little more conservative. I don't want to use the term blue nose, but a little more conservative. So these things happen, and anything that really stands out in a way that's unusual, that's edgy, will draw criticism, and especially in an era of social media, there can be a lot of back and forth.
And we did say DeVito Verdi, you know, has a history of getting criticized for some of its ads. Why don't you remind us of what's happened with them in the past?
Well, they've been the agency for a long time for Legal Seafoods, and so besides the Hillary Clinton cold fish ad, they did a series of ads that were kind of spoof on environmental advertising, and it was Save the Trout, Save the Crab. One said, "Save the trout, save it to swim on another day through golden brooks and sunlit streams, or just save it so we can grill that baby up real nice." People didn't take too well to those. The environmental crowd was a little bit upset at those. They had an MBTA campaign in 2008 banned by the MBTA. It was a fresh fish remarks thing where the fish had bubbles, speech bubbles coming out, saying things like, "This trolley gets around more than your sister." And the MBTA banned them. They went to court. They finally came to some kind of reconciliation and did a modified version of those ads.
But there have been some that were really serious, too, politically serious ads. So I'm wondering, and there were lawsuits about this, isn't that right? So does this not fall into political ad speech? You know, is that where the difference might be when you're talking about a business advertising?
Yeah, no, this falls into furniture ad speech.
Right. So what does that mean?
So I think it's exempt from the demeaning and of groups that the MBTA bans, demeaning or disparaging groups. This falls under their, if any guideline, under the guidelines of prurient sexual suggestiveness. And I think that's a phrase that's open to interpretation.
That's actually in their ban.
That's right. That's one of the things they ban. So they've just given up advocacy ads because they've been in court so many times over the past 40 years that the most recent one went all the way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court decided they didn't want to hear it. But the MBTA at that point said, "We're just not doing any political, social, religious issues. We're not doing them anymore."
And so far, do you think that they've been able to stick to the guidelines without creating a lot of headaches for themselves?
So far. I think the spokesman for the MBTA told the Boston Business Journal they had gotten two complaints about these. And there's a little bit of a kerfuffle on the on social media, but nothing really serious. I think the MBTA has really wrestled with this for a long time. And they consistently lost in court from 1974 to 2002. They lost on abortion rights issues, animal cruelty. AIDS Action had a dust-up with them, a pro-marijuana legalization group. group, and they consistently lost. And they finally got a court that said, you know, here are some guidelines that that will stand up. And to the best of my knowledge, they've been abiding by those guidelines ever since. And so they did not lose when they got there was an issue of an anti-Islamic ad that they refused to run after they had run a pro-Palestinian ad. And that was the one that went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, we're not going to hear this one. So that one's out. So the MBTA actually won that one. It looks like they've got their policy pretty well buttoned down at this point.
And do you think this Bernie and Phil's ad falls within the policy? It's okay.
Well, this is probably going to say more about me than the policy, actually. But no, it doesn't really cross the line as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I think it kind of tiptoes up to the line, but it doesn't cross it. But again, this is why the MBTA has problems in these areas, because for many people it is a matter of sensibility, it's a matter of opinion, it's a matter of interpretation, and so these are things that can vary depending on the individual. The whole idea of just looking away from it if you don't like it, some people don't find that as a satisfactory solution for these kinds of ads, the people who object to them, obviously.
All right. John Carroll, professor of communication at Boston University and WBUR senior media analyst. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, the life and legacy of famous 20th century poet and Massachusetts native Elizabeth Bishop. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. One of the legends of 20th century poetry wrote sparingly, but her work still resonates.
The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day. Accept the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master.
That's the beginning of the poem One Art by Elizabeth Bishop. It's one of her best-known poems, published near the end of her life, and it was read there by actress Blythe Danner. It speaks of an art of losing, and Bishop had to practice that in her own life. Bishop, who grew up in Worcester, lost her father as a baby. Her mother was institutionalized through her childhood, and the rest of her life was marked by tumultuous love affairs, deaths of friends, and her battle with alcoholism. Joining me to talk about Elizabeth Bishop and her work is her new biographer and former student, Megan Marshall. Marshall's a professor at Emerson College, and her new book is Elizabeth Bishop, A Miracle for Breakfast. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me, Deborah.
So tell me about Elizabeth Bishop's contributions to poetry. What do you think made her one of the giants of 20th century verse?
Well, she came to the stage of poetry at a time where it was mostly male-dominated, but she managed to sneak in a kind of new poetry that was based in the old. She was attracted to verse forms. She wrote sestinas, villanelles, but she also incorporated a kind of modernism of everyday speech and of very acute observation. So she was writing in old forms, but she was writing new poetry.
Hmm. And do you think that's why it still has such staying power?
Yes, I think so. You know, she said that to write poetry is thinking with one's feelings. I think that's a wonderful description of the kind of poetry that she wrote. Her contemporaries, Robert Lowell, Sylvia Plath, and Sexton, were writing very kind of nakedly revealing confessional poetry that was gripping at the time, but it loses a bit today when we're not any longer in the time in which they were writing and confessing. Her poems are personal, but they're also universal, just as the one that you read, One Art.
Right. So I'm wondering, you were a student.
Yes, I was.
Yeah. So describe what happened there.
Yeah. Well, I was a dropout from Bennington College and hanging around in Harvard Square, and I began taking courses at Harvard just kind of as an independent person, I was lucky to get into a workshop class with Robert Lowell. And after those classes, I transferred to Harvard and continued to really to study poetry. That became my thing. I got into Elizabeth Bishop's class my senior year, and she was not the star that Robert Lowell was. It's hard to believe that now because her name is certainly ascended beyond his. And it was a curious class. We began day one. She said she appeared a kind of small, older woman looking kind of shy and nervous. And she began by saying, "I don't believe poetry can be taught." And what were we supposed to think about that? But I came to really respect that honesty. I mean, above all, this is what she was, honest in her poems. And if she wasn't outright open about her love life, her lesbianism, a word she would not have used because she was closeted. She was very honest in her opinions about what we might do as poets, what could be accomplished. And she had arrived at poetry almost as a life raft, I think, in a refuge and a place of expression through a very difficult life. I don't think that's part of what she felt couldn't be taught. And also, I think sometimes people who have a kind of innate talent for something aren't really the best teachers of it. But the message really was you had to, be rigorous on your own. You had to teach yourself. You had to write, inspire yourself, and live the life that was going to be the basis of poems.
Right. So she lost her father when she was a baby. Her mother was institutionalized. She was in a series of homes, sexually abused.
Yes, by an uncle.
By an uncle. She was a gay woman who was closeted and couldn't come out. I mean, there was a lot going on there. Is that picture what really interested you and made you want to write about
her?
Yeah.
Of what you've just summarized had not been known before. When I began to write this book, I was very aware that this experience as a student at Harvard with these eminent poets had kind of set me up for the life of a biographer. I was close to them, but maybe only as close as a biographer might ever come to a subject. I wanted to write about Bishop. I had thought I'd write a short book, kind of a personal appreciation. She published only 100 poems in her lifetime. But then when I began looking into it, I learned that her late life lover, Alice Methvessel, who was almost 30 years younger, had held on to some key correspondences and they came to light after Alice's death in 2009. So the love affair between Alice and Elizabeth, nobody really knew what that consisted of until the letters between them surfaced. There were letters that Elizabeth had written in her late 30s when she was in psychoanalysis to her analyst. And that's how we know about the abuse from the uncle. This was something she'd never told anyone except very close friends. We also know about her early experiences of falling in love with girls and women. Previous biographers had sort of guessed, you know, they would say, well, she was working out her sexuality. We don't really know. But here, you know, we learn that she was reading Havelock Ellis when she was, a young teenager, learning about what then was called inversion, sexual inversion, love of the same sex. And luckily, Havelock Ellis was kind of, a liberal on this. She was not made to feel ashamed by what she was reading.
Hmm. And her struggle with alcoholism.
Yes. That too was becomes well, much more clear in these letters. No, that was known, but her feelings about it, she writes about it quite movingly in these letters to the analyst. One is that she began drinking, she dates it to her senior year in college as she was beginning to look out into a world where she really had no place to go, no home. She'd always had a girls. She went to a girls' boarding school, Walnut Hill School, and then the Vassar College. But this was also the year that her mother died. And even before her mother died, she had not seen her for 17 years while her mother was institutionalized. She was crying about her mother, she reveals in these letters, in the arms of her roommate, Margaret Miller, with whom she was in love but who didn't return that love. So she was drinking, and she says sometimes that was the only way that she could express herself. But she also clearly felt that sometimes she would experience visions and perceptions under the influence of alcohol and that was sometimes helpful for her art. So you can see why it was very hard for her to give this up. She needed it to express things that she couldn't otherwise. Perhaps it opened up her up to a kind of imaginative vision that she used in her poetry. But she knew quite well it was costing her the love of people she cared about dearly.
You know, she wrote to her friend, the poet Robert Lowell, quote, "It is hell to realize that one has wasted half of one's talent through timidity."
Mm.
What does that mean? Was she really an insecure person?
Yes. Well, I don't know if insecure is the term. Socially insecure, we probably say now. She had a very strong belief in her talent, and I think that was one reason she was able to pilot her way through this very difficult life. She always was very true to this commitment to poetry, but shyness really plagued her from a very young age, perhaps because she was gay and had to hide that, perhaps because of the misery in her household. I mean, she made great friends at Walnut Hill School, but one of them dropped by this very humble house she was living in Revere, and she burst into tears to have this person unexpectedly drop by and meet the dreadful uncle and the rather embarrassing aunt with whom she was living.
So, and also, she never felt that her career was where she wanted it to be.
Well, in a way, it's sort of hard to see how that could be. She won the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award, the National Book Critics Circle Award, but her great friend Robert Lowell was turning out, sometimes one sonnet a day, and here she was left with, the 100 poems. She had more still in her when she died at age 68, but I think it was more a question of output. But if you think about it, this is one thing that I tried to do with the book, to sort of situate the poems back in her life, and you see how the idea from the poem might begin, in 1947, a bus ride in Nova Scotia and Maine, a moose walks out on the road. This becomes a poem 20 years later that she reads at Phi Beta Kappa ceremony at Harvard in 1972. These poems were with her all the time, and in a way, maybe it's not that her career wasn't where she was, but she was always had something to do that was unfinished, and I think, we all know how that feels.
Right. Now, as we said, her mother was institutionalized, but she was also living at a time when other poets had issues with mental stability.
Yes.
So how was that for her? I mean, I see one quote here that's in your book. She says, "I am the one poet who's going to stay sane until the bitter end."
Yes.
So how did she navigate that world, and what do we know
about
her mental health?
Well, I think it was partly the other poets, but also that she did not want to lose a grip in the way that her mother had, and it was very important to her. It's been said that when she died of a cerebral aneurysm, she probably would have been happy to know that that was how she ended her life, not as a suicide. So many of the poets of her generation did, one way or another. So the alcoholism was not quite manageable, but it was not insanity. She needed to hang on to the very acute vision that she had, and you see it in her poetry, very striking descriptions of animals, of nature, the beaches, the way the sun shines, all these things. It was a clarity of vision that she strove for, and maybe you're right, you can see it as part of this incessant need to have a sane view of the world and to think with one's feelings.
What do you want people to understand about Elizabeth Bishop, both as a poet and as a person?
Well, I've written three biographies now, and I've come to think that there are some very distinctive brands of heroism. Some are very public, but some, like Elizabeth Bishop's, are more private. She did have a public persona in her poetry, but she, despite all that she fought against, the alcoholism, the shyness, she persevered. She made something beautiful, and she staked her life on that. And I think that's an example we can all take to heart now.
Where do you think she got, now that you've gone through all of these things that weren't known before, where did she get the guts to do that, I guess? And what was it?
Well, she had a love of language from the very beginning. You hear her talking about, in retrospect, the hymns that were sung in the Baptist church that she went to, the rhymes that stuck with her, the unusual lines. These were a way of getting through a very difficult life, hanging on to language. And this is something I can identify with. In a way, that's a bit of why my story is in the book as well, in these brief memoir sections. This is a woman who held on to language as a way of staying part of the human community that otherwise was turning its back on her.
And in the last minute here, the exact title of the book is Elizabeth Bishop, A Miracle for Breakfast. What does that mean for folks who don't
well,
know?
Yeah, this is the name of a sestina that she wrote, a very complicated verse form that had not been popular when she tried it in the 1930s, but became popular as this poem circulated out into the world. I like the title because it grabbed this kind of cheerfulness, this effort to rise above that was so much true of Elizabeth Bishop.
All right. Megan Marshall, author of Elizabeth Bishop, A Miracle for Breakfast. She'll be reading from the book at the Brookline Booksmith this Wednesday and Harvard's Houghton Library next Monday. You can find more details at our website, radioboston.org. Megan Marshall is also the winner of the 2014 Pulitzer Prize in Biography for her book on Margaret Fuller. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Deborah.
Stay with us. Coming up, the surprising life story of Julia Ward Howe, who wrote the lyrics to the Battle Hymn of the Republic. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker.
Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Most of us know these lyrics to Battle Hymn of the Republic, but the story of the person who wrote these words is not so well known. Julia Ward Howe lived in Boston most of her 91 years and is buried in Mount Auburn Cemetery. She was a mother, wife, poet, abolitionist, and toward the end of her life, a suffragist.
Glory, glory, hallelujah.
So on this President's Day, we want to revisit a conversation we had about Howe with Elaine Showalter, Professor Emerita of English at Princeton University. We spoke with her last April about her biography, The Civil Wars of Julia Ward Howe. The book is now out in paperback. In the book, Showalter tells the story of Howe's life as an activist and writer, even though her controlling husband did not approve. We began by asking Showalter how Julia Ward Howe wrote those words that we all know so well back in 1862.
At the time that she wrote it, she was really at a low point in her life. She had six children. She had more or less given up on her great dream of becoming a major American poet. She'd published a number of books of poetry, but her husband objected so strongly to her first book that afterwards she never grew as a poet. The poems became very conventional. So she'd given up on that. He wouldn't let her go out of the house to speak in public about all the things that concerned her. And she went with him to Washington, where he was in charge of the sanitation department for the Union Army, in other words, inspecting hospitals and figuring out how they would treat wounded soldiers. And while she was there, she went out with some friends from Boston to look to see a drill of the military under General McClellan. And when they were coming back to Washington, the troops near them were singing John Brown's Body, that famous tune. And her minister, who was with them, said to her, "Julia, you could write more noble words to that tune." And she said, "You know, I think I could." And that night in the Willard Hotel, she woke up in the middle of the night with the lyrics fully formed in her mind. She had been given not only permission by her minister to write, she had been given, as it were, a commission. She'd been given orders to write the poem. So her imagination was totally freed.
So was this her big achievement? I mean, certainly why she's most well known. But do you consider this her major work?
I think that it's a great poem. She wanted to write great poems. And this kind of inadvertently turned out to be one. And it is a great poem. It's not only an American poem. It's an international anthem for mourning, for vengeance, for particularly as a eulogy. It's played at the funerals of great citizens from Winston Churchill to Ronald Reagan, to Nancy Reagan. Mm-hmm. So it achieved a kind of greatness that she never even could have imagined. But I think her real achievement has to be seen in the whole of her life, and in particular what she did after the battle hymn.
Mm-hmm. Now you talked a little bit about the constraints of her marriage, and you know that her husband did not approve of her writing. Her husband, Samuel Howe, was the first director of the Perkins School for the Blind here in Massachusetts. So tell us a little bit about that. And you know, they certainly did seem to have social justice causes that they worked on together. But was that unusual at the time? And what was the sort of cultural backdrop to what was happening?
Well, he should have been the perfect partner for her. He should have been the Prince Charming who rescued her, and that's what she thought in the beginning. He was a hero. He was not only a great philanthropist and a great public figure and world famous as someone who had been the pioneer of education for blind children, he had also been a hero of the Greek War of Independence against the Turks. He was handsome. He was dashing. He believed in getting rid of the handicaps and oppression of every kind of group in the world, including slaves, the imprisoned, the insane, and so on. The only thing he didn't support were women's rights, ironically. Huh. She had always wanted to be a poet and writer, and he absolutely resisted that. He thought that no married woman should publish, that it was indecent, it was unfeminine, it was a betrayal of the marriage. And he fought her constantly on her work. She published against his will, and in fact, without telling him, her first book of poems, which was called Passion Flowers. And there were some poems in it about him and about the marriage. It came out anonymously, but within about a week, all of Boston knew who it was. And when he found out, he was outraged. He felt betrayed, as he well might have done. And he said at that point, she should change the poems, which she had to do. She was not supposed to write again. He would divorce her and take custody of their children, all of which he was able to do. So although she didn't stop, she defied him. It was clear that her poetry was kind of paralyzed. It was kind of fixed at that level. And from then on, her poems were pretty conventional. Hmm. He was a remarkable man, and it's sad that they could not be a better support to each other. But that marriage turned out very badly, and you might think it's the first place, the site in which she really understood about the oppression of women.
I'm wondering if you could read a little bit of a few parts of one of her poems.
Well, my favorite poem in Passion Flowers is called The Heart's Astronomy. Astronomy was kind of a fad then. There had been a major comet seen over the United States, discovered by another woman, Maria Mitchell. So this is a poem about Julia herself, walking around the outside of her house to get some exercise and to get away from her children who were watching her out the window. They watched me as astronomers whose business lies in heaven afar, await behind the slanting glass the reappearance of a star. Not so, not so, my pretty ones. Seek stars in yonder cloudless sky, but mark no steadfast path for me. A comet, dire and strange, am I. Huh. I think it's a wonderful poem. And she was not a steady star. She was a comet, and her orbit was unpredictable.
Right. So it sounds like, you know, she had a lot of deep, ambivalent feelings about motherhood and all of the other things that were going on. Was this writing really a way for her to kind of express things that maybe weren't talked about at the time?
It certainly was. I mean, she wasn't completely able to do it. I think women poets in the 19th century were very constrained in what they could express. She had letters. She wrote letters to her two sisters, one of whom lived in Rome and the other in New Jersey and then California. And they wrote extensively to each other. These letters are all in the Houghton Library at Harvard, and they are amazing. She wrote with incredible honesty and humor and emotion about what she was living. And I think that was more of an outlet for her than the poetry, which became, as I said, increasingly conventional and topical and occasional. But she had thought all of her life that writing would be her outlet. And after the Civil War, she began to think that she might find a better outlet in speaking, in preaching, in campaigning for women's rights.
And so that happened. Was that and then talk about a little bit about her husband, and they were married for 33 years, but then he died, and that was really when she was able to sort of find an outlet.
Yes, he was 18 years older than she was, and when they were first married, that gave him a great advantage. He was like a father figure. He was a famous man. She was a young girl. But, of course, as the years went by, he became older. She was in her prime. And when he died, she then launched on a totally new career. She lived 34 years after his death, as long as the marriage lasted. And she really forged a whole new identity for herself. And primarily, as she understood after the Civil War and after his death, she was committed to the cause of women, particularly to suffrage, but to other causes that women were embracing and endorsing during that period.
Why write a biography of Julia Ward Howe now? What was it that drew you to this story?
Well, I thought she was so intelligent. I thought she was so expressive. I was very taken, of course, by these amazing letters. But I think what drew me to her particularly was that she lived to be 91. You know, a lot of the feminist heroines, a lot of women heroines in history did not live very long lives. And I think about Margaret Fuller, who died so tragically at the age of 40, just about the time that Julia was coming into her own. This was a woman who not only lived to be 91, but worked virtually up till the last minute, who had six children, who traveled halfway around the world, including the Caribbean. She went to Europe as easily as we now take a jet plane, who wrote many books, who was a real intellectual, self-educated in many ways, and had such a passion for living and so much humor and sense of fun that, you know, I thought this is a woman really for our century. This is a woman that I think modern times could embrace.
Now, although she was born in New York, they were here in Boston. What was life like at the time? And while there may have been women around like Margaret Fuller and others who may have been inspirational, overall, was it a difficult time for women?
It was in some ways. I mean, I think Boston, I'm a Bostonian. I grew up in Boston. And I think Boston is always a pretty good city for intellectual women at any period. But she had a lot of disadvantages. When she first got married to Samuel Gridley Howe, they moved into the Perkins Institute, which at that time was in South Boston. So she was really cut off from the city. There was no real public transportation. She was very isolated. And she found it very hard to make friends in Boston. Gradually, she came to really enjoy it. And they eventually moved back onto Beacon Hill and then on Beacon Street. And she really enjoyed the society of Boston. There were a great many interesting people in the city, not primarily women who she got to know, unfortunately. And that was one of the things about the suffrage movement. When she joined the suffrage movement for the first time, she found herself in a community of sisters, really, like-minded women, and that comradeship meant a great deal to her. Some of the women she knew in Boston were very ambivalent about her. They admired her, but they were also a bit envious, a bit put off by her, and she felt the same way.
So what do you think she should be remembered for today? Was it an idea of equality for women, and how would you define that idea?
I think she should be remembered as an incredible survivor, someone who fought for her own rights, her own independence, and came to understand what that meant. And after she composed The Battle Hymn, she had an epiphany. She had a sudden vision, and she said, "All my life, I have thought that the world of men was the world. That was the world by which I set my course, from which I took my values. And now I see that there is a world of women." And she says, "It's like a new continent appearing." And that discovery is, I think, the center of her life. And she articulates it in a way that I think no other woman in the 19th century did. And she then committed herself to it. What did it mean to live in a world in which women's perceptions, women's ideas, women's needs were as powerful as the needs of men. That was what she followed. And she addressed that from her own perspective as someone who, in many ways, was inside elite society, had been the wife of a very important man, was quite beautiful, had six children, all of these things that you might see are the markings of conventional feminine success. And yet she completely embraced some of the most radical views about women that were available at her time and that I think are still very meaningful now.
Six children.
Mm. So did Harriet Beecher Stowe have six children. Not so unusual, but, you know, I think these women, when they were writing, Harriet Beecher Stowe says it's like rowing against the wind.
Elaine Showalter is Professor Emerita of English at Princeton University. We spoke with her last April when her book, The Civil Wars of Julia Ward Howe, a biography, first came out. It's now out in paperback. We'll go out on more of Battle Hymn of the Republic, this one sung by Joan Baez.
In the beauty of the lilies, Christ was born across the sea with the glory.
That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Kathleen McInerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Bruzek. We had help today from Ashley Bailey, Zoe Mitchell, and Caitlin O'Keefe. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hattie. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.